The best New Year's deals are happening now at Tanger Outlets. Celebrate with up to 70% off savings from Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. From activewear to accessories, beauty, and apparel, find everything you're looking for to kickstart the new year. The clock is ticking. Hurry into Tanger Outlets to save more. Hundreds of brands, unbeatable value. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Jill Biden was there with Ashley Biden, which making googly eyes at Trump. Did you see that photo? There was like this photo. If you guys haven't seen this, it looks like there is a seat between them. And whoever was sitting between them got up. And now it's like this awkward moment, I guess, maybe, maybe not, of them sitting next to each other. And she is smiling. He's smiling. Like, she definitely voted for Trump. Okay.
I think that our country is right now in the most dangerous position it's ever been.
Confident that there will be a peaceful transfer of power in January 2025.
If Trump wins, no, I'm not comfortable.
Take a look at what happened.
You're considered the most liberal United States senator.
Somebody said that.
Campaign rallies, not a press conference. Why hasn't she had a press conference? She's the vice president. She can handle the questions. Why not do it?
Dana, I think the most important and most significant aspect of my policy perspective and decisions is my values have not changed.
4 months from now, we will have an incredible victory, and we will begin the four greatest years in the history of our country.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Campaign Games, the game of survival for both the candidates and the voters. I'm Miss Sadie, and I am here this early morning with my friend, Rachel. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel.
And
is that our thing now? Is that that's just our thing.
Yeah,
that's the new thing.
We're just going to make it. We're just going to make that happen. So today, before we jump into it, I want to give you guys a little reminder, housekeeping situation. Yes, because last time I said house cleaning situation.
House cleaning. We blame it on the 6 a.m., but we probably would say stuff like this even if we recorded at noon.
We're so eloquent anyways, and just in general. But just a reminder that we are going through a rebrand because we have decided to keep on going on. Okay. So to make sure that we stay communicated, because this podcast, Campaign Games, is going to be rebranded to Rivera and Reeves, and it's going to have its own dedicated Substack and social media platform. So all of the links to that are in the show notes. Make sure that you give us a follow. And a reminder for our schedule with the upcoming holiday, Friday will be our last episode of the year because we're going to be taking 2 weeks off because we got holiday stuff to do. And unless everything absolutely goes sideways, because honestly, anything can happen. We're not going to be publishing anything over those 2 weeks, and we'll be coming back brand new with a fresh look, Rivera and Reeves, on January 2nd, because our schedule will now, instead of it being Wednesday and Friday.
Wednesday, Friday. Now we're Tuesday, Thursday.
Yes. So we're experimenting. Bear with us. But because you love us and we are your new favorite podcast, we know you
will.
And
it's going to be fun. We got some good stuff in store for 2025. It's going to be an exciting year.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about today's episode. Because today's episode, we got a few stories, right? We want to do a little recap or a little update of what's happened up on the Hill in regards to nominations / moving into confirmations, which, by the way, as Rivera and Reeves, we're going to be moving into confirmations, which we will be covering here, of course, because that's really what we love to talk about, Rachel and I.
Well, honestly, and even if you don't like talking about confirmations, this is the year you might want to jump on board because it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be exciting, y'all.
I think it's going to be super interesting. Anyway, so we're going to continue to cover that. So if you're interested in following that sideshow, definitely make sure that you subscribe to us. And oh, by the way, if you're already subscribed to us on your favorite podcasting app, as long as the gremlins cooperate and we have no technical glitches, you should be good regardless of our rebrand. All right. So we're going to talk about those transitions, nominations. We're also going to discuss Daniel Penny and this situation with the assassination of the CEO of United Healthcare and the recent apprehension of the alleged shooter. And I'm saying alleged because, well, it's alleged. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. Honestly, I feel like most people don't know what's going on. There's a lot of speculation going on.
Too much speculation. Some of it's crazy.
We got thoughts. I got opinions. I also got an article incoming. So wait for that. Now, let's get into the show. Let's talk about first the Trump transition updates, the cabinet picks. You know what's really interesting is that we have heard like nothing about RFK Jr.
Yeah, it is interesting.
This isn't even our notes. It just popped into my head. But, you know, you see Hegseth, obviously, he's doing his campaign. We did a whole episode on that. Tulsi Gabbard has been up on the Hill. She is meeting with senators, doing her campaign. Cash Patel is already up there also doing the same thing, meeting with senators, which actually I think he's looking really good, which yay. But I haven't seen anything about RFK being up on the Hill and meeting with senators.
I feel like he's laying low. It's interesting. I don't know if that is intentional on Trump's part to kind of, I don't know, not make him an afterthought, but I think that they're having enough trouble with Tulsi and Pete. I think that those two, I think Republicans in general are realizing that they got to pick their battles. And I feel like they know that there was a good portion of the electorate that really liked RFKJ, liked the idea of MAHA, liked the idea of bringing about more health consciousness, especially after COVID with all the vaccine stuff. And so I think that the Republicans, if they're going to be ornery, some of these Republicans, I think that they would go after Tulsi before they'd go after maybe even Pete Hegseth. I think that Tulsi scares them more than RFKJ does.
Yeah.
Oh, and Hegseth.
Yeah, I think so, especially because I think he has way more support than they would probably like.
He
does. Like.
He had a large, for whatever you think about him, he played a pretty integral part in getting Donald Trump elected, I think. I think that that was kind of the nail in the coffin when they joined forces.
Well, and I think if anything, it's reflective of the pressure campaign that the Republicans, especially Joni Ernst, has experienced. Specifically in regard to Pete Hegseth.
Yeah.
Because remember last time that we talked, we were talking about Joni Ernst and how she was just kind of like playing politics and not really saying anything about Pete Hegseth. Like it was clear that she was hesitant about him. And yes, there's other Republican senators that are probably going to be on the fence, may not even vote for Hegseth, like Collins, Murkowski, McConnell. But those are kind of like to be expected. Like they're kind of part of that package. And
yeah,
they're for some reason liked within their state because they keep winning re-election. So whatever.
It's bizarre.
But Ernst, on the other hand, would have been seen as like the outsider of those three. And so for her to not be giving that support and possibly appearing to be like that fourth vote that would keep him out. That's nothing to say that all of the other Republicans are on board for Hegseth, but she has become the target, I guess.
Or maybe like the spokesperson.
Yeah, like the representative who would be
concerned, I guess.
Exactly. So she has gotten a lot of pressure. And then, of course, there's also the discussions about if any senator does not vote for these nominees. You got Elon out there with all his gazillions of dollars, like threatening to primary them. And I think she's really felt the pressure because she just recently put out this statement. So this is a statement. And I want to do a little evaluation of the statement, but she goes and she says, I appreciate Pete Hegseth's responsiveness and respect for the process. Following our encouraging conversations, he committed to completing a full audit of the Pentagon and selecting a senior official who will uphold the roles and value of our servicemen and women based on the quality and standards, not quotas, and who will prioritize and strengthen my work to prevent sexual assault within the ranks. As I support Pete through this process, I look forward to a fair hearing based on truth, not anonymous sources.
Wow, that's a great statement.
I think it's pretty, I mean, she doesn't outright say, I support Pete as Secretary of Defense.
No, but like, she is saying, I will be supporting him, kind of almost knowing where the direction this is going. Like, I need to support him. I'm going to support him. And she also put in that nod at the end to, hey, all of these sources are anonymous. There's no meat on those bones. So let's move on and talk about actually what he's going to be able to provide in this role, and I'm here to kind of back him up reluctantly, but I'm going to do it. It was a great statement for her, you know.
For sure. I think so. It's I feel like Hegseth has kind of risen from the dead, honestly, cuz the day before we did our episode that was basically just covering everything Hegseth, there's talks about DeSantis. It looked like he might be out, that Trump might be taking him out. Now Trump has come out publicly and said, "I've never faltered on Hegseth." Hegseth says that Trump's never faltered on him. Hegseth was just recently on, he did an interview on Hannity, which that's the other thing. Like, typically when you're going through the nomination process and meeting with senators before you even get to a confirmation hearing, they're not typically going and doing interviews. And Hegseth has done Megyn Kelly, and now he just sat down with Hannity and did an interview, I think last night or the night before, where he's just kind of laying his case again as what he would do as Secretary of State, and also providing a clarification, which I'm pretty sure that it happened because of the discussion that he had with Ernst about women in the military. Now, he was really careful to say, "I'm not opposed to women in the military," which he never has been. Like, if you've watched his interviews, his issues aren't with women in the military. It's the issue of combat and lowering the standards in order for women to be in combat.
Right.
So, you know,
it was easy bait for people to run on that he doesn't want women, sound bites and whatnot.
For sure. But so far, it's looking like Ernst has got his back. Tulsi Gabbard has been up on the Hill. She's been having meetings with senators. She's had a few senators come out publicly endorsing her. She's recently gotten the endorsement of 250 veterans. So we'll see. Now, obviously, Democrats are really going to push against her because she's a quote unquote
Putin sympathizer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or Assad sympathizer.
An Assad. Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. But Tom Cotton, he was on Fox News with Brian Kilmeade. And he just flat out said, "I expect a Republican Senate to confirm all of the president's nominees."
Pete Hegseth seems to have gotten momentum behind him. But you're in Washington. You talk to these senators. You go to lunch in the cafeteria together. So is he on track? Is he gaining momentum?
Brian, I expect a Republican Senate is going to confirm all of a Republican president-elect's nominees. I had a good meeting last week with Pete Hegseth and with Pam Bondi. I know many of these nominees. Two Arkansans have been nominated as ambassadors, Marco Rubio, Kelly Loeffler. Doug Collins and I served together. In fact, if you go back 32 years to Bill Clinton's transition, there are only two nominees out of 72 cabinet secretary nominees in which senators of the president-elect's party voted against them. So no one should be surprised that a Republican Senate is going to confirm the Republican president-elect's cabinet secretaries.
Yeah, so I wonder what he knows that we don't know. It's kind of like are they putting on a show to act like they're concerned about some of them, but in the end, they're all just going to fall in line and vote?
Well, I mean, because it was like a pretty bold, like straight up statement, right?
Yes.
To just be like, yeah, they're going to all get confirmed. I'm like, okay, bro. All right.
All of them? All of them?
You don't have any reservations? Okay, we'll see.
He doesn't listen to our podcast. He needs to listen to some of our reservations, about a few of them. But you do you, Tom.
I know. But so that is kind of just the general update of what's going up on the Hill with the transition / confirmations, which we'll be moving into. When did the confirmation start? I'm thinking like
January? Yeah, it has to be. But I have been looking everywhere if there's even like a whiff or a hint of some of those already put on the docket, like on the congressional calendar, and I cannot find anything anywhere. And
you're
I have
the
been
only
looking because I am like, I want to put it on my calendar. Okay, we are going to schedule homeschool around the confirmation hearings.
We're watching this. This is part of our class.
Yeah, heck yeah, it is. Okay, they are going to know everything about election cycles. But no, I can't find anything online. So, listeners, if you have the inside scoop or you're seeing a website that I'm not seeing, send it our way. We would love you forever.
We want to know because we're definitely following this. Now, let's do a little quick sidetrack because I just thought it was just so funny and it was so great over the weekend. Can we please talk about...
Are you going to talk about the handshakes? Let you talk about the handshakes.
I am like living for this whole thing. I just feel like I know there's people in the United States right now that are still wallowing and crying. But to see Trump on a national, because that is the first time that he was out on the national stage when he went to France over the weekend for the reopening of Notre Dame after it had, like, the roof had burned down. I think it was like 5 years ago, that fire.
Yeah,
right?
2019, I believe.
Yeah. They completely redid it. They reopened it. All kinds of leaders of state were there.
Okay. They just don't hate him as much as they want you to believe they do. They really don't.
I mean, the body language does not say that. I'm just.
And I love me some body language. I like seeing it and dissecting it. And she was very comfortable sitting there. This was not a person that knows that they're sitting next to Hitler 2.0. She was extremely comfortable, smiled. They looked like they were having a mini conversation. I don't know.
And then that handshake with Macron.
The handshakes. Oh, it's great. And the whole time I'm thinking, so when I was growing up, my dad always insisted that I have a firm handshake. Always. Mm-hmm. He said, nobody likes to shake hands like with someone where their hand feels like a dead fish.
It drives me insane.
It's all warm and gooey and floppy, right? And so he always said, you got to go in confident, go in with that firm handshake. And I can't tell you, in my teenage but adult life especially, I get so many compliments, especially from men. Like, that is a firm handshake. Like, they're surprised by it.
Like,
and
yes,
so
yes, it is.
I appreciate it. It's a power move. He is definitely going into all of these international meetings like, the boss is back. Hello, I'm here. And you can tell by the body language from the people shaking his hands, they know it. They're like, mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially what I thought. Now, I don't remember being like impressed by the handshake between the two, but when Zelensky walked into that meeting where Trump and Macron both were, he looked scared.
Like a child.
He did. He looked like a child. First of all, buy
yes.
a suit.
Yes.
Please. I've been saying this for 3 years. Please buy a suit or just a collared shirt. It's not hard at all. Okay. Because I guarantee his army gear is not cheap. Like, it costs money. Use that money, buy a shirt. Anyways, when he walked in, it was very clear he wasn't running the show anymore. Like, when he would have his interactions with Biden, it was... So he seemed so confident. He seemed more
Napoleonic, honestly.
Yeah. And now he just walks in and he felt deflated.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a power move.
Honestly, the whole thing was fascinating. And to see him and Macron like basically arm wrestle like three times as they were like taking photos. And finally at the end, Trump comes in with that upper shake.
So great.
Oh my gosh, it was so funny. And then the memes that were coming out about it, like I shared this, there was this one of like an x-ray of a broken hand. It was like Macron's hand after a shaking. It's just
I did laugh at that one.
There was also this one video that I saw, and I don't know who it was that stood up to talk to him. It was a woman. And she stood up to talk to him, shake his hand, and the camera angle when it gets Trump in the frame. You look, everyone around him has their eyes on Trump. Mm-hmm. Everyone is watching him. Everyone is fascinated. Yeah. Now, you can argue that it's because of the spectacle of Trump or that America is back, or it doesn't matter. The point is that the dude is dominating the space. Mm-hmm. And to go from Biden, who's literally like falling asleep, can't complete a sentence, is being forgotten at the back of like group photos and that sort of thing, to like this, it's I don't know. You have to feel better about our position on the world stage, at least for a moment. Even if you want to claim that it's a delusional moment, fine, let me have the moment. I don't think it is, but let's just have it.
Mm-hmm.
Because after those 4 years, I think we've earned it.
Yeah. And I still want to sit down with someone who is, we're over a month out from the election and there are still people very teary-eyed, still feeling like democracy is in peril, and come January 20th, we're going to have whatever they think is going to happen. And I really want to sit with them and ask them earnestly, do you felt more confident with that guy in office, Joe Biden, who when he would walk in a room with Barack Obama, everybody literally forgot that Joe Biden was our president? Nobody's even asking about him anymore. He's clearly in severe mental decline. staffers didn't like him. They didn't like Kamala Harris. It was a disarray. Are you telling me that you felt more secure with him as a president and his staffers that are running the White House than you do about Donald Trump, who's willing to sit down and talk for an hour and a half about what he's planning on doing? He is going to shake some things up that need shaking up, that those same people, by the way, notice need shaking up. I don't believe as many people are really that upset about it as they want you to believe that they are. I think that even they are like, maybe this isn't as horrible as we've been told.
Well, it's like after he did his Meet the Press interview, right, on Sunday, I was watching the panel afterwards and they're all like, oh, he wasn't as combative. He actually asked questions. This is like a different, like even they acknowledge now, of course, they weren't doing it to the point where, because Psaki was like, yeah, he's being really skilled with the way he's talking. But what I'm still hearing is that he's still going to do all of these horrible things. I'm like, okay.
But what are they going to say when he doesn't do all of those horrible things? That's the litmus test for me, because there's a whole lot of people coming around to certain things now. Okay, well, now we've got to work together. The Republicans do have some okay ideas. And you knew we did all along. You just lost. And now you're having to kind of admit that you were sort of lying about Trump being a dictator and ruling with jailing all of his opponents. And I don't think they really believe that stuff's going to happen. I think that they just really wanted to win really bad. So yeah, they told everybody that those things are going to happen.
Well, speaking of winning, Daniel Penny, the verdict was in, I believe, on Monday, and he was found not guilty of, well, actually, it was of criminally negligent homicide, because initially, here's the thing, this was in New York. The entire situation was so corrupt. So the case was filed against him literally like 10 days after the incident. Daniel Penny's on the subway. He's a former Marine. While on the subway, a man by the name of Jordan Neely, who the media will try and portray as a much loved Michael Jackson impersonator, gets on the train and starts yelling at people, demanding either that they give him food, that they give him something to drink, that if they don't pay attention to them, that he's going to kill them all, and that he doesn't care, and he'll go to jail. And he starts to become very hostile and very threatening. Daniel Penny goes to restrain him because I think he's getting in the face of an elderly woman. And in the process, and not only is he restraining him, but he also has the aid of another gentleman who, because everybody wants to be like Daniel Penny's racist, or at least that was the narrative initially when he was charged, the man that was assisting him in restraining Jordan Neely was also, I believe he was black, right? And also,
I think that there was another Hispanic gentleman that was also somehow involved as
Yeah, and I believe one of the women that testified in his trial that actually thanked him was an elderly black woman.
Yeah, inconvenient facts that will not be brought up by the media. At all.
So now I will notice that even though that was the initial narrative at the very beginning, and obviously we see it reemerge with this acquittal, they didn't really push that during the trial itself. They didn't accuse him of it being racially motivated, because obviously that would be ridiculous. But that was like the consistent undertone, especially Alvin Bragg. It was his office that brought these charges against Penny. Initially, he was charged with manslaughter, and then in addition to manslaughter, it was criminally negligent homicide. So they go through this entire trial with these two charges. Now, in order to find him guilty of manslaughter, you also have to find him guilty of criminally negligent homicide, is my understanding of it. At some point during the trial, or during jury deliberations, the jury comes back twice, I think, with two notes. It happened on two occasions where they could not come to an agreement on the second charge, right?
Yeah, they were
on the greater charge
manslaughter.
Yeah, of manslaughter. So the big difference between manslaughter is, one is like knowing that your behavior or your actions could lead to death, and then the other one is that you are negligent, as you may not know it, but you should have known it. That's how they're like the splitting of the hair between the two. Initially, the defense was like, well, let's dismiss this, hung jury, whatever. the prosecution goes, well, let's go ahead and let's just drop the manslaughter charge. And then the judge is like, Judge Maxwell Wiley, I believe is her name, goes, okay, let's dismiss the manslaughter charge in order to streamline the process, avoid a mistrial, and they can just consider the negligent, the criminally negligent.
Which
homicide.
There's no precedent for that. This was so blatantly a attempt to get any kind of guilty verdict for anything. When that jury came back deadlocked twice on the first charge, they should have declared a mistrial. It should have been done, case closed. But they wanted a guilty verdict so bad for him. These corrupt judges, this corrupt court wanted that so badly that they sent them back to try and get a guilty verdict on the second charge, when really it was basically like a court experiment. This doesn't happen. You don't do this. And they did. And thankfully, that jury, I think the reason how they could have been deadlocked on the first charge and then come back pretty quickly on the second charge of not guilty, I think someone must have changed their mind and saw this case for what it was, that they were just trying to get this guy. And that juror said, no, never mind. That has to be it.
I think someone saw the light and was like, they're just trying to rope. Because you have to understand, the reason this is like a really bad idea, a bad precedent to set, like really poor practice, is because if this is what is going to be the norm, then prosecutors, activist prosecutors, which by the way, this prosecutor
was totally an activist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
We'll talk about her in a second. So what can end up happening is that a prosecutor can overcharge someone,
knowing that they'll grab the lesser charge, at least that.
Yeah. Meaning that they can change it later.
Yeah. This is not justice. Do not pass go. Do not collect 200. I am so glad when they came back and he was acquitted, justice prevailed. And I was so pleased with that outcome. And I think that everybody should be. And I think most people are. There are, of course, race baiters that are making this now into something completely different than what it actually is. That was pretty predictable. But I think most people see this exactly for what it was.
Well, and I'm hoping that with the election of Trump and the acquittal of Daniel Penny, that we're seeing a sign that these progressive activists, prosecutors, and judges are no longer going to be tolerated. And we will see what happens with Bragg. Does he get re-election or whatever? But you saw this before. There was like a bodega guy. Remember, there was this bodega owner that was being robbed, and then he shot at the robber in self-defense, mm-hmm. and Bragg tried to prosecute him because now that one was a little less convenient because the bodega owner was Hispanic and the robber was Black, but it was essentially the same thing. It was along those same lines. And then this prosecutor, there was this video that went out about her, about how she had in the past prosecuted a man who in the process of a robbery killed this 80-year-old gentleman. And then in this video, she's like, oh, but I didn't want to charge him with as much because he had such a hard life.
So I'm going to give you an example of something that I did with a recent case of mine. And this has never been done in my office. I had a murder case where the defendant did not intentionally kill the victim. He went into an ATM on the Upper West Side and tried to rob an individual. Unfortunately, it was an older individual. He was 86. And in the course of the robbery, he fell to the ground. And as a result, he died. This is, under the law, a felony murder, which is akin to intentional murder. However, when I first got the case, I took the time to learn about the defendant. And it was a strong case, so it wasn't about a whodunit. I knew immediately who did it. I could prove it. I could take it to trial that day and win it. But it wasn't about that. It was that the more I learned about the defendant and his life and the circumstances, the kinds of things that Jarrell was talking about, that one should take into account the trauma of that individual, I really felt incredibly sorry for him that he had gotten to that point in his life where he felt like there was no other choice but to commit this robbery.
Sorry, no, that's not your job. You don't get to pick. You don't get to pick and be selective with justice. You don't get to do this. But I don't think people are going to continue to put up with this like progressive activism from the prosecutors. And also, by the way, from these race baiting BLM protesters. Did you see this guy? Did you hear about the reactions?
Hawk Newsom.
Yeah.
Hawk Newsom.
Yeah.
Oh, I heard it.
I couldn't. So there is this reporter, this guy, it's Inner City Press. I forget his name, but his account is on X is Inner City Press. So he dedicates himself to reporting in New York. So he goes to Manhattan courthouses, Southern District of New York, everything. And he does some really great work. So he was in the courtroom at the time that the verdict was read. And he pointed out that when the verdict was read, Penny's side applauded, which the judge was like, stop it, right? Because typically judges don't like it when there's outbursts in the courtroom. But then Neely's side, specifically, he didn't say it was Hawk Newsom, but I went digging around. And apparently Hawk Newsom, who is the leader of BLM in New York, made threats in the courtroom to Penny. He said that Penny's going to be killed.
And basically, then, like, it's a small world. Be careful.
Yeah. And then when the judge told him to get out, because it was audible enough to where the judge noticed him, kicked him out. He said, it's a small world, buddy. It's a racist country toward Penny. Mm. Then he goes out on the courthouse steps and he says this.
We need some black vigilantes.
That's right.
People want to jump up and choke us and kill us for being loud. How about we do the same when they attempt to oppress us?
Right.
I'm tired.
Yep, I posted that because I'm like, this is incitement. Why is there no consequence for these people standing out there basically calling for now black vigilantism, basically saying anybody who oppresses us, we're going to have to get loud and maybe kill them, put them in a chokehold. Like, why is nobody saying, you can't say that? Can you imagine if a white guy stood up there and said that?
Well, and I don't think you can even question what he's saying. And then his father, Neely's father.
Jordan Neely's father, yeah.
Yeah, goes to speak, which, by the way, apparently, like, I was looking into Neely's background. Neely has a long history of mental health, was in the foster care system, was homeless. He saw his mother be murdered, and his father was nowhere to be found this entire time for years. Okay. Right. Now, all of a sudden, this happens. There seems to be an opportunity of notoriety, and his father pops up at the courthouse steps. He says something needs to be. Now, he doesn't blatantly say anything like Hawk Newsom, but he's insinuating.
I mean, pretty much. Yeah.
He's insinuating.
Might as well say it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Something needs to be done.
I just want to say I miss my son. My son didn't have to go through this. I didn't have to go through this either. It hurts. Really, really hurts. What are we gonna do, people? What's gonna happen to us now? I had enough of this. System is rigged. Come on, people. Do something about this.
And now the report is that he's filing a wrongful death suit against Penny.
Yep.
And I'm like, I miss my son. Dude, you weren't even around for him.
This is grifter behavior. He now is going to sue New York, which nothing's going to come of that, obviously. But it's just really sad. It's sad that, it's sad what became of Jordan Neely. And it's even more sad that some of these so-called activists are capitalizing on the tragedy of what his life became, are using his father now as a spokesperson. This is not a good look. Like, this is not okay what his father did to his son, abandoned him, and now is showing up saying that he misses his son. Where were you for his entire life? Nobody's honestly taking that seriously. But the fact that these guys, these race baiters, can stand up there and talk for
however long and drag other family members from previous cases up there.
Yeah, there was Eric Garland's mother.
Yeah, it was just, it's pathetic. And I do think that people see through it. I think people on both sides see through it. And I think you're right. I think this is kind of like the death knell in for the BLM movement, but more broadly, this racial division that people are actively trying to cause. This case was not about that whatsoever. And it's very obvious they're trying to make it. It's always obvious to me, too, when these guys are standing up there proclaiming so boldly, we're a racist country, white supremacist country. We got to have black vigilantism. And then this woman got up yesterday saying, damn all of these jurors, damn America, horrible things. And no one's even, there's maybe one person behind her like, yay. It should be roundly condemned. It's not supported by a lot of people. I think that we're seeing kind of the last vestiges of that whole racial division movement, which is really
well. I hope so. And I think, you know, everything is cyclical, and hopefully we've seen the last iteration of it, and who knows how it could reappear in the future. But I think right now people are over it. There was some tussling outside the courtroom right afterwards. Some protesters were detained. They did some protests in the streets that night. It didn't turn into anything. It didn't turn into any kind of riots. They weren't particularly large, honestly. The NAACP, they put out an interesting statement of vigilante justice. It says that acquittal of Daniel Penny in the death of Jordan Neely has effectively given license for vigilante justice to be waged on the Black community without consequences. It's a painful reminder of the inequities in our justice system. Jordan deserved compassion. Instead, he was met with violence. We stand with his family and calling for accountability. Let me just point out, there is absolutely no discussion whatsoever of the complete failure of policies in New York City and how the NAACP and BLM, for the longest time, they were talking about defunding the police, vilifying police, and then you're upset that there's violence on the street and then people feel like they have to take things into their own hands in order to protect themselves and the people around them, because there's not enough resources to take care of people, frankly, in need, who are homeless, who have mental health issues that I think they should be taken care of, or to have enough police officers to make sure that people aren't getting mugged or pushed in front of trains in New York City.
Right. This is a crisis of their own making, and they're having to reckon with it, and they are unhappy. Go figure.
And I think a lot of people are aware of that, which is why the protests didn't erupt. They're aware of the failed policies of New York, that it was not Daniel Penny. And they remember buildings in the chaos of 2020 from Kenosha, George Floyd. And I don't think, especially after all of the information came out about BLM, how they were mismanaging their funds.
Yeah, it was a corrupt organization that was not helpful, that did not, even if they said that they seek to heal a divide in our country, which they didn't say that, but even if that was what some people were led to believe, they saw that it went nowhere. It only threw more fuel on the fire. It was not what they claimed to be, and it was a corrupt kind of pyramid scheme almost, and it's fizzled out, the support for it.
Yeah. And let's remember that we've just gone through 4 years of Biden, where the promise was that things were going to be more unified and that things were going to calm down.
And they're more broken than ever. So, yeah.
So I don't think people
are falling for it. Empty promises, and people are waking up. So.
But then what's wild to me is the comparisons. I saw this, Ashley, the show on CNN where Ken Jennings.
That's the Jeopardy man. Scott Jennings is who you are referring to.
Oh, my gosh. So Scott Jennings is on the show all the time. Abby Phillips on CNN.
Yeah.
By the way, I just love Scott Jennings. Can I have...
I do, like, too.
I just want to replay him in the background. Like,
meditate. He's so darn full of common sense. And I just love that in a human. He just says normal, basic things. And they really struggle to understand them on the show. And then when they do understand them and the light bulb kind of goes off and they realize they've been got, it's just magic. He's really good at it.
Yeah, it's great. Anyways, that was a side note, because on that same show, because it wasn't Scott Jennings that did this. So speaking of vigilante justice.
Yeah.
Abby Phillips, she wasn't on there. She wasn't hosting. Someone was filling in for her as a host. And frankly, I'm going to be honest, I have no idea who this woman is. Okay. So she's filling in as a host and she brings up and tries to make a comparison of vigilante justice of Jordan Neely that she argues the right and conservatives are supporting versus the vigilante justice of the assassination of Brian Thompson, the CEO of United Healthcare that happened last week. I think it was like last Wednesday. And she's trying to be like, well, which vigilante justice, like you're okay with one, but you're not okay with the other.
You know, later in the night, we're also going to talk about Penny and the verdict there. Mm-hmm. There you also have a victim who somebody determined did not deserve to continue living, right?
No.
Yeah, tell
no,
me. Tell
no,
me which tell not... me which vigilante action is okay.
One is being proactive, right? So this kid who executed someone, executed a guy walking away from him, shot him in the back, shot him in the for no reason whatsoever. Daniel Penny is a hero. You can say anything you want. Talk to people who ride the subway every day. Because I do all the time. I do all
okay,
the time.
So let me
I can't find anyone who rides the subway who's unhappy about this verdict.
Well,
no, because the two are not alike.
They're
sorry.
Not both
try again. And everybody knows it. Stop it. That's so blatant propaganda. I can't. No.
I was just like in shock of her attempt to make this comparison that a man with no motive to kill anyone, and that was his motive was to protect those around him. There was nothing vigilante about it because he wasn't trying to take anybody out. He was just
he didn't go looking for this. He was literally trying to get from point A to point B, and then he needed to suppress violence by protecting women, children, other people by simply restraining a man who was out of his mind. On drugs, by the way, that's not vigilante justice. That's being protective of your fellow citizen on a train where you're trapped in a metal tube with a psychopath. That is not the same as Luigi deciding that he's going to go murder someone in the street and then go eat at McDonald's. Not the same. We're not going to compare these.
Allegedly.
Yeah, sorry. Yes.
So let's talk about the assassination of Brian Thompson. There are so many levels to this. Let me just say real quick before we go into this conversation, what we're not going to discuss. Okay. We're not going to go. First of all, we got another 20 minutes or so on this podcast. So we're not going to go down the rabbit hole of all the conspiracies and whether he did it and whether or not. I'm working on an article on that. So if you want to go down that rabbit hole, and I got a lot of thoughts about that rabbit hole, subscribe to my Substack because I have an article in the works. But the details of it was last week, I believe it was on Wednesday, December 4th, Brian Thompson was on his way to, if I'm not mistaken, it was like a shareholders meeting or investors meeting.
Yeah.
For the United Health Group. Now, a lot of people are getting two things. There's United Health Group and then there's United Healthcare. United Healthcare is underneath the group because there's other insurance companies that are under United Health Group. So there's a CEO of the group and then there's a CEO of United Healthcare. So we're talking about that's where Brian Thompson falls in that. He was due to be one of the first speakers at this conference or at this meeting. So he was very early walking on his way to the hotel for it. A man comes up behind him wearing a jacket, a backpack with a firearm that has a suppressor on it and kills him, assassinates him, like straight up walks up behind him and assassinates him. He runs across the street, bike, park, disappears, right? He was recently apprehended. Was it Monday that he was apprehended or Tuesday? I can't remember.
I feel like it was yesterday. My days, I can't keep track. But yeah, he was apprehended in Altoona at
Pennsylvania.
McDonald's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you guys have seen the surveillance footage, the backpack was found in the park with Monopoly money in it, a jacket in it, and a few other items in it. What was not in it was the firearm that was used in the assassination. And so that was one of the first things that was picked up. Then he was apprehended in Pennsylvania at a McDonald's. There's a lot of discussion about how he was identified. Is this the same guy that was in the photos? I think it's the same dude. Okay. I think it's the same dude. People are going to be like, but he wasn't wearing the jacket or he wasn't wearing. jackets, well, you can change them.
Focusing on the eyebrows.
Yes. There's issues with camera resolution. Cameras distort color. Lighting distorts color. Jackets can be changed. There was a jacket in the backpack where he was found, where the backpack in Central Park. It is possible that he had a different jacket and that he's changed his jacket. Why? Because it makes it harder to identify you if you're running off. Okay. You see spy people do this all the time. So my point is that there's possibly more than one jacket. Maybe there's more than one backpack. Maybe there's a backpack that was specifically for the assassination. Maybe he had a backpack hidden in the bushes that he swapped out. There's all of these possibilities. Okay. So there's a lot of rabbit holes going on. I'm starting to rant about the rabbit holes. I'm going to save that for later. Okay.
Mercedes wants everybody to calm down about the rabbit holes is what we're picking up on here. People are getting a little bit over their skis. They're getting a little overly excited, we believe, when it comes to this case, and people need to simmer down and wait for more information.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. We're just going to wait for more information. So the news breaks about his assassination. And immediately, what I do want to definitely discuss is the gross reaction to this man, who is a father, by the way, I think of three children. I know that he at least has two teenage boys.
That's horrible.
Who grew up, I think his father was like blue collar, maybe a farmer. He, on his own, became successful. Like, he's not a man that comes from money or success. Like, he did this on his own. And he is walking on his way to a meeting, and he is gunned down in the streets of New York. Okay. Let's just recognize that, which I think is, and then what I think is really gross is the objective celebration that has come out predominantly from the left, but also some people
also
on the far right.
Right
that are celebrating the murder of this man. Annoyed by it.
It is very disgusting. It's abhorrent behavior. And it just really proves that we have become a culture that dehumanizes others so much so that a father can be murdered in the street and people are going to work themselves up so much and kind of trick themselves somehow into being able to be
to
okay
justify
with it.
Yeah,
to justify. It. And it's really, well, it's scary because this time it's this man, but who's the next person that it's okay to celebrate the murder of because you don't like his job. You don't like what he's chosen for a career. You don't like where he goes to church. Like, this is, it's scary. It's scary how much I've seen people do the whole, it's really sad, but, and that, but that speaks volumes. There should be no acceptance of this type of behavior. Everybody should be appalled by it. Full stop. That's it.
This celebration that is coming from the left and, you know, again, some on the right about him being killed because of how horrible healthcare for profit is. Now, you can have a discussion and you can, obviously, we have a broken healthcare system, but universal healthcare is not the solution. It is not the solution to shoot the CEO of a company who's just going to be replaced with another CEO and is literally going to accomplish nothing in regards to change. If you really want to have some change in the healthcare system, maybe this alleged shooter, the one who was arrested, was Luigi Mangione, comes from a very predominant family who has money, who has resources. This guy is a valedictorian from high school. He graduated from UPenn. He went to an Ivy League school. This kid has resources. He has abilities. Mm-hmm. If he really wanted to create change, instead of shooting an innocent man in the back, how about you use your resources and go after and advocate for the change that you want in the healthcare system?
Well, of course, everything you say is correct, but they that are celebrating this, those depraved people, sorry, I'll just say that, because I think if you're celebrating this, there's a screw loose. It's not okay. They'll say that what he did was he woke people in America up to have a conversation about healthcare. As if people haven't been talking about our healthcare system and how it's broken forever. And they're always going to, because we live in a country with millions and millions and millions and millions of people, and no healthcare system is going to be perfect. And no healthcare system is going to be able to cater to every single person. And does that mean that there shouldn't be discussions about how to reform it, make it better? Yes. But don't come at me like, well, it brought about a conversation, though, that was much needed. That's the same thing as saying, kind of glad it happened because, well, it got us all chatting about it. This is not an okay line of thinking at all.
The perfect example of this is Taylor Lorenz, who the moment that it was announced that this guy, Thompson, was barely dead 24 hours. It was like the news had literally just hit, and she was essentially celebrating it. She did an entire post on her Substack titled "Why Quote We," and she's kind of making the argument that it's a collective we, as in we're having a discussion, but she goes, "Why we want insurance executives dead," defending her position because she got called out by it. She goes on to Piers Morgan. Did you see this?
And yes, how I did.
She literally said that she felt joy. And then she tried to walk it back. But let me tell you, it was not a successful walk.
Too
back.
Late. Yeah, too late.
Let's move to the other story, because Taylor's been waiting patiently here. So this issue of Brian Thompson, one of the top healthcare executives in the country, I'm just curious why your first reaction would be to his cold-blooded execution. And people wonder why we want these executives dead. And then you later commented when people were giving you a lot of blowback, "I'm not alone," you said. "Healthcare executive down with party balloons" was on a next post that you commented on. Why would you be in such a celebratory mood about the execution of another human being? Aren't you supposed to be on the caring, sharing left where, you know, you believe in the sanctity of life?
I do believe in the sanctity of life. And I think that's why I felt, along with so many other Americans, joy, unfortunately, you know, because it
joy?
Feels like...
Serious?
I mean...
Joy in
I
a man's execution?
Maybe not joy, but certainly not, no, certainly not empathy. Because again,
we're watching the footage. How can this make you joyful? This guy's a husband, he's a father, and he's being gunned down in the middle of Manhattan. Why does that make you joyful?
Tens of Americans that be murdered. So are the tens of thousands of Americans, innocent Americans, who died because greedy health insurance executives like this one push a policies of denying care to the most vulnerable people. And the many millions of Americans that have watched people that I care about suffer and in some cases die because of lack of health.
So should they all be killed then? Should they all be killed, these healthcare executives? Would that make you even more joyful?
No, that would not.
But why not?
And,
why are you laughing?
I think because, here's, because it doesn't, it wouldn't fix
you
the system.
You seem to find the whole thing hilarious.
I find your question funny.
A bloke's been murdered in the street. I don't find it funny at all.
I don't find it funny that tens of thousands of Americans die every year and because they are denied life-saving health care from people like the CEO.
So, and then after all this, rightfully, because mind you, the reason she's on Substack, she tries to say, oh, I've gone independent. No, it's
no,
because...
you got canned by Washington Post.
The Washington
because
Post...
even they are like, this girl's toxic because she is.
Well, and she got canned because she had posted publicly and she claimed that she was hacked, but...
Yeah, right.
That's not true. That she posted publicly that Biden was a war criminal because of how he's funding or providing funding to Israel in their fight against Hamas. And so she characterized Biden as a war criminal. She's supposed to be an objective reporter for The Washington Post.
All of the WAPO's journalists are very unbiased.
So they separated ways, but let's be frank, she got canned. Okay.
Yeah.
And she has been, I think she's the perfect representation of how gross this response has been. And then also the people that are like swooning over this guy because he's an attractive 20-something year old.
Keep those thoughts in your head. Don't say these things. Why? It makes me angry. I think that line of thinking almost makes me, well, it makes me almost as angry as the people who are like, yeah, this should happen to all of the CEOs. That it's just so gross and awful. But I've seen less people saying that, I mean, there's a good amount of them. Trust me. Go on TikTok and you're going to see plenty of lefties being like, yeah, this should happen to all the CEOs. Okay, gross. But there's way more people being like, oh, it can't be him. He's so hot. He's so attractive. It can't be him. Look at him. You know, what? Do not say these things. Guys, come on. Can I just, as an old lady, can I give you youngsters some advice? If you are going to post something or say something online, think about it just for a few minutes before you do it. Is this advisable? Is this a good idea? Would I want a future employee or, I mean, excuse me, employer to see this video of me talking about an alleged murderer and how I wish he'd take me out for a date? Don't do that. Just don't. And it's really gross how they're, it's just dehumanizing across the board. We're not caring about this man who has a family who was murdered. And now we're talking about this alleged murderer, how attractive he is. I just cannot believe that this is the dialogue in our country. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I think to me, the scariest thing is this mentality of not separating an individual, a human being, from, in this example, we're talking about the healthcare system. Like, this man is trying to manage this company within the restrictions that are presented to him because of overregulation, because of mm-hmm. all the hoops that he needs to run through in order to make something profitable. And maybe you don't agree with the idea of healthcare being for profit. By the way, it is here in the United States, as problematic as our healthcare system is, and as much as reform that is needed, it is here in the US where you can, for the most part, quickly call up your doctor, get an appointment mm-hmm. within a week. And then if you're also mm-hmm. having a horrible diagnosis of cancer, yeah, I'm unfortunately, some of those cases do lead people into medical bankruptcy, but also you don't end up dead like you do in, you know, the UK or Canada, because you're on a waiting list for a year or 2 years before you can be seen by a doctor. And a lot of times they come here to the United States to seek treatment mm-hmm. because of that. And those are the people with means that are able to do that. And then to not be able to separate this man from his job and yeah. just say, like, he's just a greedy murderer, which is what Taylor Lorenz is saying. So yeah. he should be shot in the streets like a dog mm-hmm. because he's no longer human. I am just so disgusted by the entire thing.
Yes. We dehumanize. We say whatever we want to say. We have no filters, no critical thinking skills, nothing outside of our own basic primal urges and needs. And people just pop off whenever they want and say things, not realizing that these are other human beings we're talking about. And I think we are seeing that in the division in our country, how we can look at someone on the other side of the aisle and castigate them as some of the worst people in history, Nazis or white supremacists, how we can cut people off from our family gatherings, from our relationships, from our life because they don't vote the way we want. We have a real dehumanization problem.
Well, and the slippery slope is not a fallacy. Like, if you're going to be justifying, like, oh, well, he was the
he deserved
head of
it.
This.
He had it coming.
Who? Yeah. At what point are you going to? You can make that. That is a subjective opinion, okay? Mm-hmm. And at what point are you going to be able to make that argument for anybody else? I mean, think about how long we were hearing about, you know, punch the Nazi. Why do you think Trump? Like, there's been 2 assassination attempts on him. Mm-hmm. It all stems from the same mentality. And I just think mm-hmm. it is a really bad idea.
It's very dangerous. You heard it here first. Do not talk about how attractive an alleged murderer is. If that's the first thing you're discussing when you're talking about this horrible event. And secondly, if you are excited about this whole thing happening, you need to reevaluate your life choices right now.
Well, and there's a lot of discussion about, I mean, look, I'm going to admit this is interesting to say the least. Like, this guy has it had it all, right? He comes from a family of influence, like influence in Baltimore. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, he has a cousin that's in government. His grandfather started, I believe, a business that was like nursing, and then they got into country clubs. The school that he went to, I think it was like $40,000 a year.
Yeah. Definitely privilege. He came from a lot of wealth, privilege, affluence, mm-hmm. probably a lot of influence too. so where he lived.
The claim is that he was doing really well, and then he either had a back condition, or it was a back condition that was exacerbated from a surf accident while he was living in a co-living community in Hawaii. And I believe it was a lumbar condition. There's on his header and his X profile, there is an X-ray of what looks like a back with screws in it. Like, it looks horrific. The reports are that he was living in Hawaii. He told his friends that he was co-living with that he had to go back to the mainland for back surgery. And his family says that he kind of disappeared afterwards. So he's been essentially missing for, I don't know, like 6 months, almost a year, where people aren't hearing from him. They're posting on his ex account, hey, are you coming to this wedding? Have anybody heard from you? What's going on? So he kind of like disappeared for a while and then has apparently reemerged with this situation. Now, what I find really interesting is that this dude's face was kind of like all over the place. And it wasn't until he was arrested that you heard any kind of statement from his parents or from his family. Like, you would have thought that he would have recognized him and that maybe somebody would have come forward and being like, I know who this is, unless they were obviously trying to protect him. So I think that's really kind of weird with his
parents. Yeah, and their statement was kind of guarded and a little bizarre, in my opinion, too.
For sure.
When they did come forward and say something.
So there's thoughts that he had some grievances with the healthcare system and that is tied to his back surgery. There's also a lot of other theories out there, which I'm not going to get into right now. Now, one of the big things that is driving me personally a little nuts, okay?
Mm-hmm. I know what you're going to say.
Is this talking point that I'm seeing from people where they're like, oh, you're telling me this guy who came from privilege, who went to an Ivy League school, who, you know, and they keep listing all these, was successful, was doing this, who had a high IQ, was found with the gun that he committed the assassination with in a McDonald's eating hash browns.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. He was too smart for this.
Haven't we been talking for, let me tell you what I think. This is how I see it. I think this is a guy who came from privilege, who had everything, his entire life was kind of laid out and it was perfect. Okay. He was doing really well. He was successful. He has this back injury. He's like in his 20s. Let's just point out that mental health conditions do pop up in your 20s, okay? He starts dabbling in psychedelics. He's living an alternative life. He's gone to an Ivy League school, which I am positive, I'm pretty sure, I would be willing to bet money, has been exposed to the narrative or the discussion of white privilege and people of privilege are oppressors. And therefore, he starts to feel guilty and he's trying to live a different lifestyle, which is probably why he's in this weird surfer co-living like situation. Then he has these discussions. Things start to like bubble up because it makes sense because he was going to this Ivy League school. Like all of a sudden, because he went to an Ivy League school, we're going to fall for this fallacy of like appeal to authority that all of a sudden,
or that he would be too smart to do something so ridiculous.
There
and
are
stupid.
So many idiots that come out of Ivy League schools, like so many idiots. Okay.
Haven't and we, I'm, we, I feel like we have seen we've, this. It's played out a lot in the last.
We've been
four,
discussing
10,
this
20 years.
I know. Like, this is not a shock.
It's not a new talking point, but I think it's really difficult for some people to get it through their brains that going to a very expensive Ivy League school just because you can get straight A's, that does not make you smart. It makes you able to test well, and it makes you able to be book smart in some circumstances, but it doesn't make you wise. It doesn't remove the fact that you probably have had everything handed to you on a silver platter your whole life, and you decided to do something without thinking through the repercussions. Or maybe he did and he's just out for blood. I don't know. But the whole line of thinking, like you said, that you go into an Ivy League and you come out a gentleman and a scholar is hilarious.
And then you're just too smart to do anything that, like, let me point out, I actually looked this up because the talking point was kind of, and I don't even know if this is the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that I'm annoyed with people questioning it. Like, I think it's completely valid to question anything. I think, you know, still innocent until proven guilty. I stand on that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is the guy. All right. But I don't think it is out of the question that this could not possibly be right. the guy. Okay.
Right.
And I also don't think that this argument of he went to an Ivy League school and he's smart, so therefore he couldn't do this stupid thing makes sense. Because I'm not expecting, this guy isn't some career criminal, all right? This wasn't a hired hitman. And by the way, this people like just because he was using a silencer does not mean that he was a hired hitman. When he saw him fire on Thompson, he saw his gun drop and he hit him in the back of the leg and he was pretty far back. That to me does not scream pro assassin. That means someone who is like hesitant to come up and shoot someone in the back and doesn't have control of their firearm. Okay. And that is just me talking as someone who shoots regularly at the shooting range. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I am no professional, but I've done that drop a multitude of times, hitting in the wrong place and not hitting the target. Okay.
Yeah.
So to me, he seems like a privileged kid where things went wrong. He got upset. He let himself be sucked into this mentality of oppressor versus oppressed, which is something that we're seeing really common, which aligns with the discussion, especially among the left, since this assassination. And the fact that he was nervous when he was arrested makes sense to me because this is a stupid 26-year-old privileged child who thought that he could get away with something, who maybe thought the hubris of his education and him being so much smarter than others would mean that he'd be able to get away from it. And the fact
if we think that these elite colleges don't churn out radical extremist ideas in some of these students, and a lot of look at what we've been watching on college campuses since October 7th. It is definitely this oppressor, oppressed mentality, radical ideas about personhood, race, what this crazy ideology that is permeating these schools. And to think that all of these kids get out of there and they're like, yeah, I don't make much of that indoctrination that was pumped into my veins for 4 years straight. No, it seeps into their bones and it changes their minds and their hearts and their souls. Obviously, if you're willing to go, like you said, shoot someone in the back who's just walking on the street, I don't know. These places are a fertile ground for like extremist ideas, and we have to discuss that. I mean, and to think that just because he went to a good school, to think that they're going to be like siloed off from crazy ideology that's enveloped most of higher ed in our country is just, it's foolish.
Well, and then also people are like, but why did he have to look? Most of the time, I actually looked this up because it was driving me nuts. Most people, when they are apprehended after committing a crime with a firearm, are apprehended still in possession of one because they feel like they need to defend themselves. In addition to about like 30% of them have the one that they committed the crime with. And the fact is that this particular gun is being labeled as like a ghost gun, right? Is how it's being described, which means it was either pieced together. It doesn't have a serial number. And some portions of it were probably 3D printed, meaning that it can't be traced. So maybe he's thinking, I might as well keep the gun. You can't trace it.
Yeah.
I mean,
again.
Now, I will also point out that during his arraignment, the only thing that he protested was because at the time of his arrest, he was found with several thousands of dollars in U.S. currency and several thousands of dollars in foreign currency, in addition to fake IDs, passport, and the firearm. And I think a Faraday cage for his cell phone, okay, which is supposed to kind of like block signals and stuff like that. The only thing that he protested at the arraignment was the money. And he said, I don't know where the money came from. The money was planted. Now, that was a report from CNN.
But Aaron, one of the most interesting parts of that particular hearing was actually his statements after the conversation about bail. The prosecutors basically stepped up there and made the case why they believe that this man should be held without bail. They mentioned that he is awaiting potentially an arrest warrant coming from New York City as one of the major reasons. But they also said that prosecutors noted that they found him with $8,000 in U.S. cash, $2,000 in foreign currency, currency, his passport, and also a Faraday bag, which is basically a bag designed to stop transmission of cell service or other sort of things like that. At the end of his speech, the prosecutor's speech, Luigi Mangione said, I actually want to address two of the things that you said. He said, I don't know where that money came from. I'm not sure if it was planted. And then he also said that that bag was waterproof. And the term that the prosecutors used when discussing the Faraday bag, the ghost guns, the 3D printed silencer, was the prosecutors used a phrase saying, this is criminal sophistication. Luigi Mangione said, I don't know about any of this criminal sophistication when addressing that. But it's just interesting, Aaron, that of all of the things that were mentioned in that court appearance, the two that he noted or took issue with was the currency and then that bag. Aaron?
So that's the only thing that he protested. He didn't protest the fact that he had the gun. He didn't say that the gun was planted on him. And then on the following day, and this is to me kind of representative of his mentality and like this narrative that you're seeing from a lot of these Ivy League schools of oppressed versus oppressor. He was being taken into for the extradition hearing, which he's fighting extradition to New York, but he was being taken in. He was wrestling with the police and he shouts something along the lines of, this is unjust, an insult to the American people. And that this is my something about lived experience. I don't know if it was like, this is my lived experience or this is the lived experience, but there was something
sounds very Ivy League. Oh, my gosh.
For sure. So I'm just
$60,000 a year or $80,000 or however much UPenn costs. That is a hefty price to pay to have your child come out. And now he's potentially going to go to Rikers for 50 years.
There's a lot of interesting discussions that can be had regarding this. And for me, what does this mean where we are as a country? Mm-hmm. That there are people who are going to lionize this guy as some kind of like a folk hero because he took out the CEO of this conglomerate of healthcare or whatever.
Yeah, we don't want to go down that road. We do not want to live in that world. People need to tread lightly and really, really investigate why they would feel happiness over this course of events.
But we'll see how this develops. I think there's just a lot of really, and I understand why there's a lot of suspicion and why people are quick to, some people are quick to go there because we do have a history of our institutions and our media blatantly lying to us. But I also want to say not everything is a conspiracy.
And just cool your jets, everyone.
You know, and I think it's fair to question, you know, what's being told to us. I'm not criticizing that at all. Also be aware to not just like jump on a narrative or a bandwagon just because everybody else is doing it. And I think that's my hesitation.
I think maybe the takeaway is just there's wisdom in waiting and letting things flesh out before we jump to, I get it that like you and I were talking earlier, some people like to externally like process in a very like public way, but when we're dealing with human lives here in such a just really kind of alarming set of circumstances, it is wise to wait and gather all the information you can before we go about sensationalizing a really, really tragic story.
Yeah, I think so. We just need to wait and see what happens. I'm just so grossed out by the entire thing, honestly.
Same. Let's just wait. Be chill with Mercedes and Rachel. For once in our lives, we are calming down. We're like, let's just take a beat, everybody.
So let's go ahead and wrap up today's episode. But before we do that, let me go ahead and remind you guys about our schedule. We're going to have one more episode on Friday for the year. Then we're going to be gone for 2 weeks. Then we're going to be coming back January 2nd as Rivera and Reeves, where we have our own dedicated platform on Substack and all the social media channels, not all the social media channels. We're on Instagram and X. Okay. So follow us over there so you make sure that we stay connected. In the meantime, I guess we will see you on Friday for
it'll
another
be a fun episode.
We're going to do kind of like a, what is it?
Like year review.
Yes. Like a debrief of campaign games, how we started, what our favorite stories were for the election season, and what we're hoping for in the new year. So make sure that you listen to us on Friday for that episode and give us a follow if you're not following us because we are going to be your new favorite podcast. please leave a 5-star rating, leave a review, share your lovely notes, because we love to read them and share them. And if you share us on your socials, make sure that you tag us so that we can share you back. So that's it. Thanks for tuning in, and catch us for one more episode of Campaign Games.
Only one. Aww.
The game of survival for both the candidates and the voters. We'll let you guys go. Bye.
Bye.
The best New Year's deals are happening now at Tanger Outlets. Celebrate with up to 70% off savings from Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. From activewear to accessories, beauty, and apparel, find everything you're looking for to kickstart the new year. The clock is ticking. Hurry into Tanger Outlets to save more. Hundreds of brands, unbeatable value. Plan your trip at tanger.com.